something. I'd like to ask, do you have any advice for, practical advice for family life? Like, how to be a good Buddhist while balancing family commitments? Yeah, thank you.
Yes. Well, the models for life in a relationship or in a family is of good friendship, what we call kalyana mitata, and so seeking to be the good friend to your husband, your children, your parents, and encouraging them to be your good friends. And so good friends are those that help you to see or to become aware of your blind spots and help you to overcome your weaknesses and your defilements, to give you feedback, kindly and timely feedback, and for you to provide that to them. So it's helping each other to overcome defilements and to develop in all that is good and wholesome. So it's really tough to do this, the Buddha's education, to let go of defilements, abandon the unwholesome, develop the wholesome, purify the heart. It's so difficult for anyone to do that. And if you can find a partner in life who has the same goals and the same aspiration, and to be able to help each other on that path, then that's a wonderful thing. It's not a bad thing. And to be able to share that and to instill that same aspiration in your children is a very meritorious thing and a beautiful thing. So family life is not necessarily a distraction from Dhamma. It's adding complications, and there are a lot more temptations to suffer than maybe as a monk. But you know, it's taking on this idea of I'm a Buddhist, mean I'm a learner. I'm always learning how to be a good daughter, to be a wife, to be a mother. I'm not a graduate. I haven't got this worked out yet. I make mistakes, but I'm trying to work on this. So, you know, you don't have to be super mum, you know, and make all the right choices. You make mistakes, but it's your underlying purity of your intention which is important. Generally, the Buddha pointed to two factors in relationships and communities. That's a harmony of view and a harmony of sila, of conduct. And these are the most important factors for long-term healthy relationship. So harmony of view, essentially right view, and like this kinds of beliefs that I spoke about just now. It doesn't mean that you and your husband would have the same understanding and belief and opinions on everything, but there is a mutual respect and there's a general harmony between you. And similarly, an understanding of and a commitment to precepts. So if there's commitment to precepts and same general aspiration and understanding of our values of what's right and what's wrong and what's good and what's the purpose of our life here as human being, then this can be very enriching life in as a household. And so that I think it's really important to remember is there is absolutely no doubt that this is the very best time in history ever to be born as a woman. absolutely no question. You look at the lot of women in the past, there's never have women had the same access to healthcare, to education, to make choices of lifestyle, to get married or not get married, to have children or not get children, to work or not work. You have so much autonomy and freedom and a choice to make a good life for yourself that women have never had this before. So really recognize this and take advantage of it.
Kanajan, first of all, thank you very much for your excellent sharing and for your compassion in coming back to Singapore again. Kanajan, may I know how did you feel when you learned that you know you are going to be the biographer for you know the great Longpo Cha, and could you give us you know some preview or some interesting experiences that you had you know when you were actually practicing you know under Longpo Cha? Thank you.
Well, I was asked to. To write or to, in fact, to begin with, it was a kind of a group effort and then everyone else fell away and I was the main person in writing the Thai biography, the official Thai biography of Longpo Cha. So I really started on this project of writing biography in the late 80s. So it's basically been my whole life, you know, it's part of my whole identity is you sort of the Ajahn Chah biographer. So, you know, I can hardly remember a time when I wasn't involved in this in some way or another in some version or other. So it's a great honor for me. And as someone who, like from childhood, I never really felt at home in England or in the West, and always had an incredible strong, almost gravitational pull to Asia, and originally to India. And the moment I can remember, the moment I arrived in India, I was 17 years old. The moment I could possibly leave England, I did, and just feeling this sense of joy and homecoming, and so I've lived in Asia. You know, more or less, you know, I'm now almost 60 and I've lived in Asia since I was 17. And this is home for me. And I learned Thai very quickly and I took to the whole Thai culture and Asian culture. And I just, it's what I'm most comfortable in. And so, in that way, I was kind of like unique amongst the Western monks, even in that almost all of the Western monks have eventually felt some pull to go back to propagate Buddhism in their own countries, or they spent many years overseas. And that's never been any interest of mine at all. My interest has been in the Theravada Buddhist countries, essentially Thailand. But I'm interested in Theravada Buddhist culture and helping to contribute to it and to protect it and to propagate it, and so that being the case, given my commitment to this to Thai Buddhism and Thai Theravada tradition, and my facility with the language, then I was in a kind of a like a unique position amongst all the Western monks to be able to do this work of presenting the teachings of Longpo Cha to the world. And I feel greatly honored to have that opportunity. Yeah. So despite the fact that, you know, I do feel so at home in this part of the world, I do have this sort of a broader sense of a broader context than many of my Thai colleagues, and a more analytical mind than is common amongst the Thai bhikkhus. And so I think that being able to look at the Ajahn Chah tradition and compare it with other traditions and to try to tease out the most salient factors and in a way perhaps that a Thai biographer might not have been able to do. That's my hope. Anyway. So I didn't spend so much time with Ajahn Chah before he became bedridden and stopped. But for me, from the moment I met him, this is incredible faith in him individually and this conviction that he was an arahant and that arahantship is possible. It's not something that was confined, restricted to the great teachers of old. But and of course, I'm speaking to someone with that. You know, I didn't have any psychic powers or any ability to really know. But this is the nature of faith. And of course, at the beginning, I didn't speak any Thai at all. But I was determined to learn Thai as soon as I could. But I think that in the early days of monastic life, where it's very tough, in those days physically, it was really demanding. The climate is very difficult. It's very, a bit like Singapore, very hot and sticky. You're working, you're getting up 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and not getting to bed till 10 at night. 11, and you're living on one meal a day, and just generally it's really tough. And what keeps you going in the beginning is not that you're getting this, you know, drip of incredibly profound teachings, but it's seeing someone who's done this training and proved that it works. That's what you need more than anything else. And this is what great monks like Ajahn Chah give to us. Like for instance, you know, the monk that comes here, like Lumpo Liam. I mean, I feel if I come into his presence and bow to him and just see him sitting there, that's already I don't even you know, not so worried about listening to a Dhamma talk. It's him himself which is such a wonderful gift to the world. Of course, his teachings are wonderful as well. But for me, it's just someone who's who has made the teachings his own and proved the efficacy of them and proved that they really do work. And this is something I found in Lumpo Cha. So I found that, like in writing, in a lot of the books printed and published with Ajahn Chah, I think you always get like a kind of a Walt Disney Ajahn Chah figure. You know, this old grandfather figure with a walking stick, and you're doing something a bit stupid, and he stops, and he maybe points his stick at you and smiles and says something wise, and then your life has changed forever. And he walks off, you know. And even with a great teacher like that, it's not like that, you know. It's a lot harder work. And so I wanted to give, you know, a lot more context and background and to the whole monastic training, rather than that kind of highlights package that, you know, sometimes you get in some of the books.
I have a question, because I read that you mentioned that you have been practicing since 17, and you were born in 1958, so this math, you've been practicing for about 42 years. So it's been quite a long journey, especially being in Asia alone. So for these 42 years of practice, how has the journey been? Has there ever been a point where you felt a sense of loneliness away from your family and practicing in solitary
style after the 5 years Vasa? How do you actually cope with those years of solitary practice? And also, you mentioned very interestingly that there is no non-practicing Buddhist. A Buddhist has to be practicing. So is there perhaps one practice that you have to do every day that helps you to keep up with the faith and kind of improves your cultivation of Buddhism?
My own life, I mean, I can't summarize 42 years so simply in this kind of forum. But I, from the day that I arrived in the monastery, I can say I've never had a single moment where I ever considered leaving the monkhood or disrobing. I'm just so, I feel blessed to be able to live this life. And there's nothing that I've ever wanted to do in life that I can't do within the framework of a monk. And all the things that I want to do most in life, I can do most easily and most effectively as a monk. So I'm a great champion of the monk's life. And I've always loved my own company, and so I love being alone. Loneliness has never been a problem for me. I'm a very happy monk. In terms of daily practice, yes, to start the day with a period of meditation. A lot of people do try to meditate every day, but they will often meditate before they go to bed, which is okay. I mean, it's good just to let go of the stresses and strains, and it's better than taking a sleeping pill. Often, you know, it just sort of drifts into sleepiness, and it's rarely people can maintain a very a sense that meditating before going to bed leads to great perceivable progress. It's I'm not saying not to do that, and I think it's a really good thing to do last thing at night. But the most important thing is to meditate first thing in the morning. If you meditate at night, even if you have a kind of clear meditation, you wake up in the morning and it's like a new chapter of your life, you know. So you don't see any results, or not any clear results. You can say, well, this is happening because of what happened last night. Whereas if you meditate in the morning and you keep a close watch on your mental states throughout the day, you begin to observe, yes, if I meditate in the morning, I feel there's a lot more patience, a lot more mindfulness, a lot easier to let go of things, don't get so stressed out. And that's when you really begin to see, yeah, this is a really important part of my life. Because you're seeing the effects in your daily life. And that's why it's also, of course, when you're meditating first thing in the morning, your mind is relatively clear, and if you've slept sufficiently, you can develop good meditation and clear meditation at that time. So we talk about formal meditation and informal meditation. So sitting and walking is the formal meditation, and being mindful and developing right effort throughout the day is the informal meditation. And these two things affect each other. So you'll notice that if you meditate in the morning, to say it's that much easier to sustain mindfulness and awareness throughout the day. And by the same token, if you are mindful throughout the day, when you do have time to sit and walk, then it's that much easier to calm the mind and to free the mind of hindrances. So these two things work together and influence each other.
Thank you, Ajahn, for your talk. So
I would like to ask a question that pertains to studying or working. So I find it hardest to maintain my mindfulness during studying periods because my mind is just running wild, trying to solve various problems or to stuff in more information into my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this will apply to work as well. So what advice do you have for maintaining mindfulness during work?
Well, the basic mindfulness practice in daily life is keeping the precepts. The precepts are your basic safety net. As long as you're mindful of your precepts and not breaking precepts, then even if you lose mindfulness, it's not a disaster. It's something you can do about it. But if you lose mindfulness of your precepts and break any precept, then there are serious consequences that will arise and there will be real obstacles to progress in Dhamma. So in times of study, things where you really have to give rein to that part of your brain, then sometimes you just have to accept that you're not going to be totally peaceful and you don't want to be peaceful at that time. But what you do want is to be mindful and to prevent unwholesome dhammas from arising. So, you know, thinking and working on theories and testing formulas, that's okay. That's not a big problem. But if your fear and anxiety about the results of your studies and these various kinds of unwholesome dhammas, those are the problem. So if you can protect your mind from them, it's helpful. Also, very mundane point is like time management and according the right amount of time to things and having regular breaks. And if you're working for over a long period, then to stop at a regular, maybe set your alarm clock and just have like 1 or 2 or 3 minutes just watching your breath, or sometimes some yoga posture, something just a little bit more physical, but just to reestablish your mindfulness at regular intervals. But like to beware of what we call vipava dhanha. You know, it's like you have a commitment to this kind of study at the moment. You know, if your mind's conflicted that, you know, you want to do this, you love doing this, but at the same time you don't want to feel like this, you know, that this is creating unnecessary problems. Yeah, this is the nature of it. You know, when you're working on this kind of work, there's this kind of mental activity going on, and it's not still, but as long as it's not leading you to be completely lost or to be acting or speaking or thinking in ways that are harmful to yourself or others, it's workable. It won't be a major obstacle. But you can't expect that kind of thinking to be peaceful. It's just not. Yeah.
Ajahn, thank you for your sharing. I have one question. If with regards to motivation, I realize that in times when I have, when I feel spiritually inspired in one day, especially on Saturday because that's where all my Dhamma activities are in, and then the next day I feel completely exhausted, completely demotivated, and not even really wanting to fulfill my basic obligations as being a student or being a daughter, etc. So it has been happening for about half a year, and I really cannot reconcile, you know, like swinging between these two extremes. And I do understand the concept of as in there is impermanence, but I still feel a lot of dukkha coming from this swinging in between
being fully made, fully motivated to live my life, to realize my potential, and the next day, gosh, I just can't take life anymore. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, the this point of vipava tanha, you know, it's not so much what you're doing as not wanting it to be like this, or wanting it to be some other way than it is right now. So that's the direct thing that you need to work on. So in the Dhamma talk, you know, I was saying that there are no things that force you to feel depressed or low or down. Now there are triggers, and there are things that will encourage you to feel that way if you're not mindful. So at the moment you're maybe you're having to having some real joy and from the Dhamma practices on, and then you want to hold on to those, but you're living a life where you just can't, because the causes and conditions for those kind of mental states are not accessible in the kind of life that you're living right now. So you have to make peace with that, and you have to also, as I suggested to the other person, the other questioner, like very important first thing in the morning, to be very diligent about your formal sitting meditation, because that's clarifying the mind and calming the mind, and a lot of these mental states just don't arise when you have this starting off the day in a very wholesome way. But also sit and just give some thought, this wise reflection, ways about why what you're doing right now is useful and valuable and worthy of commitment. So if you're a medical student, then you're creating the causes and conditions to reduce and eliminate the suffering of many fellow human beings in the future. And that's when we talk about right livelihood in the world, how many livelihoods are there in which the livelihood itself is wholesome? Now, many people can lead a wholesome life and do good things as business people in the commercial field, but you know, apart from say doctors, nurses, teachers, social workers, so few people can have lead a life in which the work itself is something that is so useful and meaningful, not just to yourself, to many other people. So it's a wonderful thing to be able to have this opportunity to train as a doctor. So this is the way to talk to yourself. Yeah. Oh, it's tough. It's like medical training. It's so hard. You know, it is really. Over many, many years, so much hard work. But remember why you decided to do it in the first place. And look up, and when you think of doctors that, senior doctors and professors and people that you look up to, and that you're on the path to following in their footsteps. So this is also Dhamma practice. Finding skillful means of dealing with negative emotions. It's not, I can't practice because I feel like this. This is the practice right now. This is the learning. So these are the kind of emotions that are coming up right now. How do I deal with this? You know, how can I reframe my attitude and my thinking about this in such a way that it's not dragging me down, but it's actually contributing or in harmony with my spiritual goals.
Namo Buddhaya Bhante. Firstly, I would like to apologize for my broken English. Okay. I have skin problem actually, very sensitive skin, but I love to join the meditation retreat. Every time I join the longer meditation retreat, my face become a lot of pimples, start itchy, and then start come to the snacks. And then I start to scare. I start to think it's not suits me, this kind of life, you know. But I really love to join the retreat. Some Bante or some Meji in Thailand asked me to stay longer for a few months. But in my heart, the fears comes that the itchiness will spread all, you know, from face to neck. And then how to overcome this?
Well, first of all, you know, recognizing anxiety and fear as anxiety and fear. These are mental states that arise. They're not who you are. They're visitors. Okay. So the moment we think something might happen, and then the more we think that something might happen becomes something, yeah, it really may happen. And then the more you think it's going to happen, you know, so the more you think about something, the more real it becomes and the more likely it becomes. And we create all this suffering for ourselves. So I'm not sure about the condition in your face, but often these kinds of condition are coming from the mental state rather than from the physical health. And so sometimes there is a lot of stress, or maybe trying too hard or forcing too hard, so when we get stressed out, people have different physical reactions. And skin problems are often caused by stress. So I'm not sure if the particular kind of effort that you're putting in when you go on this retreat is maybe too much pushing and forcing yourself, and then your body is saying too much, you know. So maybe it's worth trying just a little bit more relaxed, a little bit more maybe metta meditation, loving kindness meditation, and I think you may find that is helps with the condition. But even so, you see, in monasteries generally we don't have mirrors, so this is a good, don't look in the mirror when you're in a monastery, then you don't have to worry, because nobody, the whole idea is you don't have to be attractive, you can have spots in a monastery and nobody cares. Okay, so it's wonderful, you know, what best possible place to have a skin condition in a monastery, you know, and people are obviously there concerned, and there are medicines available and you can treat it. But I think my guess is that this is coming from some stress that you're feeling in the monastery rather than because of Buddhist training.
Ajahn, I would like to know when is the proper time to do chanting, before meditation or after meditation, and what type of Bali chanting do we have to chant if you have no time?
Yes, so like in the Buddhist practice, it's like, or in the curriculum, like meditation is like the compulsory subject and chanting is like the elective. So, you know, it's not, so some people, the chanting, they really love the chanting and it brings up a lot of joy and they can be very calm and peaceful with that. And then those people should do a bit more chanting. Other people, they don't really feel not very helpful in their practice, and they still do a little bit less. But usually we chant before the meditation, because when we come to the meditation hall or meditation room straight from our normal life, usually quite a lot of things going on in our head. And if we just sit down straight away, you know, like it's the first few minutes or maybe more than that, it's just like house cleaning, you know, there's all this stuff going on in our head. But if we have this intermediate practice, chanting, it's a way of just changing the mind and moving from the worldly mind to the more calm and focused mind. So your small activity, that you're chanting, you're using your voice and so on, but it's a way of calming the mind and preparing for meditation. So generally we chant before meditation. But there's no fixed rule about this because everyone's different. And if you like to sit first and meditate and then chant afterwards, that's fine. You have to see, try it out. What's it like when you chant before? What's it like when you chant after? And see which you enjoy. And this is the most important thing. So hard to be consistent as a lay meditator and keep doing it every day. And sometimes you're lazy. Sometimes you don't feel so good. You have to really try to keep it up. And the most important thing is you have to enjoy it. You have to look forward to it. You know, see, this is the time of the day that I love the most, like early in the morning when I'm just by myself, and really cultivate this sense. It's my favorite time of the day. So if you chant, you know, and you feel, yeah, this is what makes me happy, that's fine. Yeah. So before is okay, after is okay. Yeah. Both is okay.
Maybe the last two or three questions, Ajahn, is it okay?
Can I ask, how do you deal with friends who try to convert you and keep the friendship? Because they are like really good friends. I mean, not try to convert you, but we have differences in like beliefs. Yeah. Kind of like
the
Methodist and the evangelist and kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a long time since anyone tried to convert me, so I'm just trying to. I remember this is a story. After I'd been in Thailand for 6 years, I returned to England to visit my family, and then I went to visit one of our branch monasteries, and we caught a train from London, and we arrived in the local town near the monastery quite late at night, about 9-10 o'clock at night. There was three or four monks, and we were walking along the road. And suddenly this car parked, and like three or four people came very quickly across the road towards us. You know, you think, oh, it's like, you know, what's going to happen? And one of them came up to me, and they were Christians. And they said, what do you believe in? And, you know, six years as a Buddhist monk, I didn't have a good answer. I said, maybe ask him. He's a senior monk. So this is, again, related to my talk. You said it's not like about believing in things, okay? You know, in Buddhism, we have no idea, we have no concept that converting someone to be Buddhist is a good thing to do. We don't want to do that. We have the respect for other religious traditions, but that's not how they look at us. In those traditions, they believe that we're on the way to hell, and that they, out of compassion, they want to help us. So they feel it's a good thing, and their duty and their responsibility to their religion to try to convert people so that you can go to heaven with them. So one thing is just to recognize that they are coming from, you know, the genuine concern for our well-being. But you also have to be firm sometimes. And you said, yeah, I understand what you're telling me, and I respect your belief, but I just don't believe this. And I'm a Buddhist, and I'm happy to be a Buddhist, and I'm not going to change. And I really don't need to hear that. I would like to ask you just to stop, because you're wasting your time. You know, I'm happy to be your friend, and I like your company, but, you know, this, please, this is enough. I really am not going to change my my religion. And so if some people ask you about, you know, this, when people from other religious tradition, you know, one thing I ask somebody is like, what is it? I'm assuming that, you know, that you don't think you're a perfect Christian or a perfect Muslim. And say, no, of course not. So can you tell me, what is it that prevents you from being the kind of Christian that you would like to be? Or what prevents you from being the kind of Muslim that you think you should be? And then usually people will say, yeah, well, you know, I get angry sometimes, and I lose my temper, or sometimes I'm very jealous, and I have unvirtuous thoughts and things. Yeah, you know, in Buddhism, we have a lot of very good techniques for dealing with negative emotions, and you can borrow these. You know, you don't have to be a Buddhist to make use of these things. And so it's not like a sneaky way to convert somebody, okay? But this is, for me, this is what, as Buddhists, you see, that in my view, the weakness of these other traditions is they have very high ideals, but no practical means of bridging the gap between where you are now and how you're supposed to be. And so people feel guilty and feel, you know, insecure. And we can say, like, as Buddhists, this is something we can give to people of other religious traditions. We can give them some Buddhist techniques to enable them to be better Christians and enable them to be better Muslims. Not because we want them to be Buddhists, but because we don't have a copyright on these teachings, but they are effective and they are helpful. And maybe that you can share something with others. But sometimes I think as Buddhists we're too like passive and too you know, too easily like steamrolled by, you know, this people is like, you know, you've got because this is the thing about that kind of, you know, when people have this faith and belief in books, they become very strong, you know, but it's a strength which is rather rigid, you know, and it means that you know, you have to keep away from people who have other ideas, and you have to just believe and don't doubt. So in those religions, doubt is the number one enemy. You know, everyone's afraid of doubt. But in Buddhism, we look at doubt and we understand doubt, and we're encouraged to ask questions, and it's not considered sinful or disrespectful, but it's part of our duty as Buddhists to keep asking questions and looking at things. And so what I'm saying is that when people try to convert you, in a way it's a good thing, because it forces you to really, what is it? Why am I a Buddhist rather than a Christian? Or what can I say is, no, I'm not saying for you, but for me, Buddhism gives me this and this and this. And this is so important in my life, and I would never want to give this up. So you have to be a little bit more, it's not just sort of loyalty to the name of Buddhism, but you have to be very clear and precise about what is it exactly in Buddhism that is not available in other religions. Not to say we're better than them, but to say this is why, you know, I would never give up my Buddhist religion.
Good evening, Tan Ajahn. Not sure how to phrase this, but maybe to describe the issue here. There's a struggle, the sense of like fear, anxiety, stress, and a lot of self-doubt in my own practice. Like when I'm facing stress, anxiety in a lay life, but strangely, whenever I go to a retreat or meditation, like a place where you can just put everything outside there, and you come into this place where you know, you don't have to deal with the day life, the issues there. Then there is a lot of calm and just, you know, at ease. So the thing is, Ajahn just mentioned about how we should do the training. But the struggle here is that the training, you know, to really learn to be steady and composed, even in face of adversity or in face of very major challenges, very stressful times, is so hard. And then I came to a point where I realized that it's not about rationalizing it, you know, because perhaps for a person who is more of a rational thinker, sometimes you tend to just think through it and try and rationalize it. But it seems that actually that doesn't take the stress and the anxiety and the fear of, you know, in fact, once that rationality is not there, once the emotion is actually stronger and takes over, the stress and the fear and anxiety is like, whoa, you know. So there's actually a struggle here. Like, unless I'm in a context or a place where I can say, oh, just let everything be and not deal with it, and then there is that calm. But otherwise, when you have to face it, you have to deal with it. So how do we take that training into the real, when we are really facing it?
Yeah. First of all, I think that when we go on, if you go on retreats and time in monasteries, just time to like forget everything and get away from it and just put all that stress away. I sympathize, and sometimes that can be a lifesaver. But long term, it's not such a good way. And because it means when you go back to it, it's even worse, you know. You're constantly looking as this is unbearable, which I, you know, have to get away from every now and again just so that I can survive. Whereas I believe that often in stressful situations, there are some things which are, you know, are just given. They're just part of that particular way of life, or that particular profession and livelihood and life situation. But there's also a certain element that we add to it by the way we think about things, the way we approach them, and our own mental states. And this is what the work is, has to be done, looking here in the way in which you're unnecessarily contributing to the stress, rather than merely reacting to a stressful situation. But if you find that the given, the unchanging stressful elements are so strong, then I would suggest that you make some changes in your life and look for a less stressful way of living in the world, because it's just too much for you, and you need to reduce the amount of stresses or things encouraging stress in your life. So it's not just a matter of, you know, getting away from it and calming your mind and then coming back. You know, this just goes round and round. It never comes to an end. You need to be coming to the sources of it. You have this analytical mind, then turn that analytical mind on the stress itself. Like, is the stress constant? Sometimes you feel more stressed than other times. So what is it that conditions this increase in stress and the decrease in stress? What are they, internal factors or factors in the situation and the people around you? What are the thoughts and the beliefs and the expectations and the desires and the fears which affect the intensity of the stress? So this is the kind of work, this is the kind of analysis that needs to take place. Also, on a practical level, in every day, even if you're leading a very busy life, there are always short periods of time when you don't have to be thinking about things. So it might be standing in the lift, or walking from a building to a car to a building, walking from one room to another room. And so there are many short periods of time, 1 minute, 2 minutes, and those are the time you need to reclaim those minutes and just relax the body, do this body sweep from the head down to the feet, just relax, take some deep breaths, reestablish your mindfulness. So throughout the day, if you are every hour or so, you're just relaxing the body, stabilizing the mind, bringing the mind back to the breath, then you prevent this drip, drip, drip of stress throughout the day from becoming too strong. So this is an example of something that you can do in your daily life.
May I just ask a follow-up question? Because this morning, Ajahn mentioned something about you can't control what you cannot control.
Yeah.
And if we try to do that, actually creates a lot of stress.
Yeah.
So that's one, there's awareness that there's this, sometimes it's due to this, like the idea that there are things that you need to have some control over, but yet you have no control.
Mm.
And that actually presents a lot of stressful situations to really deal with such situations. So, as practitioners, right, do we just acknowledge, is it good enough to just acknowledge that, you know, this is really beyond control, and you just have to face it the best way that we can?
Yes, absolutely. And maybe it's not as bad as you think. It's not sure. So, the Ajahn Chah would often talk about planting a tree. You plant a fruit tree, so you choose, you have the control, you choose where you're going to plant it, and you water it, and you take care of it, and you protect it from bugs. So these are all the things that you can do. But whether that tree grows fast, or it grows slow, or the fruits are bitter or sweet, you cannot control that. That's the nature of things. So the wise person recognizes in what areas can I exert some control, and then I exert the control, and then you let go of everything else. And it's learn to let go of the results of your actions and put the effort into the quality of the actions. My mother is, I often criticize my mother in public forums. My mother is a champion, Olympic standard warrior, okay? And she'll worry about anything, you know? If she hasn't got anything to worry about, she'll find something, okay? So it's her life. So I've tried over the years so many different ways of persuading her to give up her worry. But probably the most successful is not a Buddhist, necessarily a Buddhist way, but I'm going to share it with you. And it's sing a song, okay? And this song is Que Sera. Do you know this song?
Yeah.
So whenever you get really stressed out, just say, okay, Sarah, Sarah, whatever will be, will be. Yeah. So you try sing that song to yourself.
Thank you.
Namaskar, Tan Ajahn. My question is, forest tradition has a high emphasis on Pome Ajahn, Gruba Ajahn. So like Ajahn Chah Patto is one of the early generation master, but in our time, many of these Pome Ajahn or Buranapap, So, what should we look in a good teacher? So, if we want to follow, like in our time, Paul Meng Ajahn.
I think the most important feature is you don't try and work out, you know, don't get upset. Like they say, he's an arahant. No, no, somebody. So I heard some. He really knows. He's in the inside. He says actually he's only a Sakidagami. Yeah, well, I was at this monastery and I heard this monk said he was a Sota. You know, so this kind of gossip, you know, about monks and their attainments, and I want the best. I want an arahant teacher, only like platinum standard. But it's not really the point, and you can't know. And even monks or arahants, it doesn't mean that the arahants are always the best teachers. You know, teaching ability and understanding of Dhamma don't always go together. And sometimes great teachers attract some very unpleasant people around them. You know, it's just people are just, I want to be close to the great master. And those kind of people can be really unpleasant sometimes. So being close to great masters is not always so great. So rather than getting caught up into this, is he at that level or is he not at that level, you come back to this very simple standard that the Buddha gave us for so many different of these kinds of questions in life is when you're receiving teachings from teacher over a period of time, do you find, generally speaking, that your defilements are becoming less and the wholesome dhammas are increasing? That's the gold standard. That's like the standard that you can be confident. Are you growing in the dhamma because of studying and learning from this teacher? Is the amount of greed and hatred and delusion of these things feeling just a little bit less? And that's what you should look to for a teacher. And sometimes there are things that go on. It's almost like a chemical reaction. You know, you can pay respects to some teachers and you feel incredible admiration and recognition that this is somebody who's really realized the Dhamma, or you really have confidence, but you just feel indifferent. And there are other teachers where you just feel this sense of connection, and yes, this is kind of like a sympathetic chemical reaction that happens. And like I had this feeling with Ajahn Chah when I met him, so very fortunate.